Our speaker today is going to be Reggie Newkirk, and the topic of the presentation, Hellbent for Harmony. Sounds interesting, doesn't it? Okay. Reggie grew up in Brooklyn, New York. In 1968, he moved to Alberta, where he attended and graduated from the University of Lethbridge with a degree in history and philosophy. Soon afterward, Reggie began a career devoted to the protection of human rights. For 17 years, he has served extensively in this field, working for federal, provincial, and human rights, and provincial human rights. Reggie has worked in the areas of Native rights as executive director of the Yukon Human Rights Commission, in labor relations as assistant director of the Canadian Human Rights Commission in Vancouver, in family violence prevention as the executive director of the BC Institute for Family Violence. He is currently a volunteer in a number of community-based organizations in Regina and Lumsden. Reggie runs his own consulting company in Lumsden, where one of his chief activities is spearheading the Institute for Healing Racism workshops with colleague, journalist, and educator Nathan Rutstein. Reggie and Nathan have co-authored a guide called Racial Healing, the Institute's Racial Healing, the Institutes for Healing of Racism. Together, they have facilitated more than 42-day introductory sessions in Western Canada, Ontario, Nova Scotia, Michigan, Maine, and New York City. Married to a Canadian woman for 47 years, father of three and grandfather of six, Reggie made Canada his home and worked in a human rights career hell-bent for harmony and beyond. So I'll just turn the microphone over to you.
Good morning, and let me say this about what she just said. I did not make my home in Canada. My wife made my home in Canada, all right? Because when I said, well, let's go back to Brooklyn, my wife is European descent, white. She turned black, and my God, she was scared, and I don't blame her. I really don't blame her. And besides that, I feel pretty good having been in Canada all these years and what have you. Well, I'll get a little more into that a little later about how we met, which was, to me, quite fascinating. And we were talking about that last night and this morning as I was writing my little notes. I don't read speeches, okay, because sometimes the paper gets in the way of what I really want to share. Excuse me. So, here we go. I did some research on Unitarian Universalists and so forth, and I had been familiar with it when I was in the U.S. Air Force back in 1961. Funny, people weren't around then, what have you. But and that because I was searching. My family's faith community was Second Baptist Church. And for those who don't know who the First Baptist Church was, why we became the Second Baptist Church, because the First Baptist Church were white Baptists. Second Baptist Church were black Baptists, only in America. I mean, the United States, excuse me. This is part of America, right? Need to keep that clear. I need to keep that clear as well. Sorry. And what I found, I'll tell you what, my summary of what you folks are about. I'm not projecting anything onto you, anything, but just what struck me as I read through everything and started summarizing it. I said to my wife, Cindy, I said, gee, golly, these folks are really quite open-minded seekers of truth. They take an intelligent, logical approach to religion, but a logical approach that includes spirit and spirituality. They're non-judgmental. You have a non-judgmental creed, is what I was thinking. Creed. And it's a good creed to strive to live up to. How's that? All right? And but the creed allows a vast array of beliefs, thoughts, perspectives, and so forth. And so it is not a catechismic approach to spirituality or even to community. One of my backgrounds was I was a Roman Catholic kid growing up. After I got tired of the Baptist, Second Baptist my judgment, crooks in my neighborhood. We had five storefront evangelical churches on my block in Brooklyn, and across the street was a Roman Catholic church. And I have to admit, I quote, converted to Christianity for the most, the most non-spiritual, non-ethical reasons you could possibly think of. They got more days off of public school than the Protestants. And that was it. Okay? And gotta be, yeah, you know, gee, you became a Catholic. What happened? They got more days off of school. That's why. And then at another point, I kind of thought that, gee, I just might become a priest. Then puberty struck. And that was the end of my priestly aspirations. So, kid growing up, struggling with a lot of different issues, as any kid would do in any generation and so forth, I was raised by my mother and my grandmother. In fact, I spent more time with my grandmother than my mother, even though we lived in the same house. So I call my grandmother Mama, and I call my mother Mother, because my grandmother was my mother's mother. Have you? And my birth father didn't have much to do with me. I remember a couple of birthdays between whenever I could think about it to about 18 when I left home, going to the U.S. Air Force. I can remember maybe four or five occasions when I saw him and so forth. So I have my grandmother's name, her married name, Newkirk. My father's name is Fields. My mother's name was Marion Newkirk. So, anyway, that's preliminary. But I was, I suppose, you know, the title, I was thinking, consulting my wife, and said, she said, you know, she gave me the theme, Hell-Bent for Harmony, because the way she looked at my life, what have you, it seemed like I was determined to do everything and anything possible to achieve, at all costs, to achieve my ends. Except not a lot of illegal things. Yes, I shoplifted as a kid. And the stuff I shoplifted, there were clothes. And the girls raved over the clothes. Oh, where'd you get that from? No strings. How'd you get it? You know how. Oh, you look so good in it. Next weekend, I was down to No Strings again, checking it out, seeing what was next. To be put a pickings and so forth. Did my grandmother and mother know this? Nope. They had no idea. The only one that had an idea was my aunt across the street. My Aunt Ethel, favorite aunt. Loved that woman. She was like another mother to me. And spent a lot of time with her and her kids and so forth. And she would say to me, you know I have seven kids, Reggie. I said, yeah, auntie, I know that. She says, and you know, they hear a lot of things on the block. And I hear that you are, how she put it? She said, you collect a lot of things from Nostrum's that you don't pay for. Yeah, something like that. I said, yeah, auntie. She says, when are you going to stop? I said, now that you know, I'm going to stop. And I did. All right. That's kind of the upfront side, the secret side that my family didn't know anything about, was that I was a warlord in a street gang called the Corsair Lords. And we were involved in gang fights, street battles, what have you. A good buddy of mine, his nickname was Cooley, died in my arms because a gang snuck up to a school where we were in an evening center playing basketball, and we heard scuffling outside. We ran outside, saw three guys dashing into the dark, and there was Cooley on the steps. I picked him up, and good God, his guts came out of him. They almost disemboweled him. I pushed him in. A couple other guys pushed him in. There was no 911 in those days. And it took the police about 2 hours to get there, and he was dead when they arrived. That became one of a number of signal moments in my life. Another was after Cooley had happened, and I told myself, I really should get out of the gang. This is not a life promoting enterprise, being involved with the street gangs and so forth. In those days, in the 50s, 1957, 8, 9, 60s, a lot of young people were being killed as a result of street gangs in Manhattan, the Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens, Long Island even in some instances, and Jersey, New Jersey. So the next big episode in my life was we had what the media called rumbles. These were gang fights. And there had been a big call. And the gang I belonged to, the Corsair Lords, another gang, the chaplains, were against the bishops, the stompers, and so forth and what have you. And there was an arrangement to meet at Coney Island's cyclone ride. And we thought we were in good stead, so forth. And we had surrounded them, have you? And guys were passing weapons. Here, you take this pistol, I'll take this knife, you take that sword, you take this hatchet, and so forth. There were serious weapons and so forth. Then their gang had a second wave. They came and they surrounded us. So we were in deep trouble, have you? And this one little guy, nicknames, his name is Rat. I never knew anybody's real name in the gang. And he looked at one guy about his size, and he was about that tall then. He just ran up to him, punched him, and we all ran. About 60 of us, and there was about twice as many as them. Police were coming up on horses, and they saw this wave of young people. And we said, officers, these guys got guns and knives and so forth. You mean to do so? You know what they did? They turned their horses around and took off. That's right. I guess, you know, near the 200 youth was too much for two police officers on horses and so forth. So we're running back to the subway, the L train, means the elevator above ground and so forth. And you're supposed to pay. Well, we leapt over the turnstiles and ran up, and there was one guy on their side. He must have been a sprinter because he caught up with us, leaped over the turnstile and so forth. I went into a car about three cars down, and he went into another car, which was his mistake. Because the car he went into was one of our brother gangs, the guys called chaplains. They actually called themselves the Mau Maus, and they were wicked. And the car I went into, there was no gangsters or hoodlums in it, just normal people. Some of them look like y'all here. Not quite as stunned, but nevertheless look like y'all. Okay. And I had a brand new raincoat on, nice trench coat my mother brought me, what have you. Well, okay, I'm sitting there, and I hear guys screaming and hollering. I went down to a few cars down, and I saw these guys beating up on this one kid. I said, look, man, this is not what's supposed to be happening. Leave this boy alone. Leave him alone. They said, no, we're going to kill him. We're going to kill him. I said, okay, I'm out of here. I went back to the front car where I was sitting. Within not even 15 minutes, this kid comes through, and blood is pumping out of his neck. So I knew enough about first aid to know that an artery had been cut in his neck, because that's what pumps. Veins, it ooze. Arteries, it pump. So I went over to him, and I said, lay down. And I put my hand on his neck, and the blood wasn't stopping. I took my raincoat off and wrapped it around his neck, damn near choked him to death, I guess, and just held it there. Next stop. More police than I've ever seen in my life came on the train. And they were arresting every person that was young, male, and so forth. And they grabbed me, and I'm still holding down this kid's neck, what have you. And I said, well, you can grab me if you want, but you better grab his neck, because his throat's been cut, and the artery is pumping blood out, and he'll die. So first aid people came in. They had him with them, paramedics, and they helped the kid. I'm sitting over on a chair next to this lady, and I said, okay, up you go. I said, where are we going? He said, well, you're probably one of those gangsters and so forth and what have you. And the lady said, you know, sir, I don't know if he's a gangster or not, but I do know he's probably saved that boy's life. And they let me go. I thought I was off to Rackers Island. And if you ever watch any of those TV shows about Rackers Island, that is not a place any human being would want to go. So, why is that, to me, important? It is important to me because it challenged me to deal with what I called internalized racism. I didn't trust white people because they were white people. That's it. I didn't trust my school teachers except my kindergarten teacher. I didn't trust my high school teacher except my math teacher. He was really cool. And my coaches, basketball and track coaches, who were white. But they treated people fairly. It showed no preference to anyone. What they were interested in, what was your abilities, your talent. And I remember Mr. Lewis, our track coach, said, and I don't care what color is the packaging it comes in. All I'm interested in is talent and potential talent that can be developed. That struck me. I never heard that before from any white person. And didn't hear it from a lot of black people at the same time. Why? Because they, as I was, captured in this internalized racism, which is an internal sense of inferiority. But we act out as tough guys and gals, as though we know all there is to know about anything that ought to be known. And what we were really was ignorant. An ignorance that informed not only the culture of the society we lived in, but it informed the culture of our families as well. And people say, well, you know, what did your mom do? My mother, pregnant at 18, she didn't finish high school, but a baby. My grandmother looked after me while she went off to the Garment Center in Manhattan and did peace work. You know what peace work is? Yeah, in those days, she used to get after me because I tear a shirt. She says, you know, it took me 40 pennies to pay for that shirt. In other words, she had to sew collars on shirts and 40 of them before she had enough money to buy a replacement shirt and that sort of thing. She came home and fed us kids, made food for our family, and then she worked in my grandmother's beauty parlor. Usually she started there about 7 and she worked to midnight. So she was out of the house at 6, back at home around 5:30, cooking, preparing food for us, and then working another 5-6 hours. And my grandmother was just there from like working from 7 to 11 every night. Except Sunday. Now, did my mom know I was a thief? Nope. Did my grandmother know I was a thief? Nope. Did the boys in the hood know I was a thief? Yep. Why was I a thief? It wasn't because we needed it. It was because I was playing to the tune of what the streets said a man was. Why? Partly because I had no father. So I didn't know really what a man was, what a man's responsibilities are. No. I could cook, I could wash floors, I could iron clothes. Guess who taught me all that? There ain't no man. I changed my sister's diapers, and when our first child was born, I taught my wife how to change it. How to clean the diapers, because she didn't know. She knew a whole lot of other things, but that she didn't know. I'm a better cleaner than her. I clean the house, wash dishes. You should see me. I'm Superman. I'm so daggone good. Have you? And I took over. Huh? Yeah, you can rent me now. But it happened simply. We were living in Pincher Creek, and we were just newly married. All right. And, about a year or two. And she fixed supper, and I'd been to work and came home and working with the kids and so forth. Literally, we only had towels at the time. And she said, okay, I'll do the dishes. I cleaned up the table and took the dishes in, and I was ready to wash. She said, no, I'll clean them up. Well, 30 minutes later, she had two dishes washing. She was out there looking out the window. She's an artist. She's seldom here, you know. I said, sit down. She said, why? I said, we'll be here until the next millennium before you finish those dishes. And from that time to this time, she's never washed dishes when I'm home. Because if I wanted time with her, I'll get them done, and then we can have time together. So it was pragmatic from my point of view. All right. So I didn't tell you, but before I left for the Air Force at 18 years of age, I thought I was going to become a Jesuit priest. Didn't I tell you that? Yeah, and what struck? What happened? Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Because after I did some more study, I thought the Jesuits, I didn't think they were real priests. I thought they were scholars and so forth, and, you know, went around teaching and educating and so forth and what have you. And it was when I found out that they did all that, but they had no relations with women, I retired. My thought, my aspiration. And so I graduated from high school. Vietnam War is raging, okay? And I couldn't get a deferment because I couldn't afford to go to university. I wanted to go to New York University. Well, back in 1951, credits, a credit in New York University was $150. That was just one credit. And you had to take two credits in order to get the deferment so you didn't have to go draft into the military and so forth. And parents couldn't afford that. My mom and grandmother couldn't afford that. So I went in, I joined the U.S. Air Force and became an air policeman of sorts. They called the Combat Defense Force. We guarded missile silos around this base where I was stationed, which was Laurie Air Force Base in Denver, Colorado. And we would ride out into the prairies about 50 miles or so, and there was all sorts of Titan I missile silos preparing for the Russian invasion, all that sort of thing, which I'm happy to say never happened. But it wasn't because I had anything to do about it, okay? Well, there, I was reflecting on this, and I said, holy mackerel, to my wife, you know, in my neighborhood when I was growing up, there were three white people I liked. The vast majority of people in the neighborhood was black, and some Hispanics, Puerto Ricans, but mostly African Americans. Mr. Sacco, who ran Italian delicatessen, Mrs. Kelly, who was Irish, and her husband, Mr. Kelly, right across the street from us, that had a confectionery, sold all kinds of candies and so forth and what have you, but they didn't sell Lucy cigarettes. You know, that cigarette, they didn't, yeah, you know what that is, okay. And then there was a pharmacist at the other end of the block, what have you. And those people treated me and all the other kids in the neighborhood like we were human beings. And when the riots hit in the 70s, those three stores, businesses were not touched because my family and other families stood outside. Said, you burn what you want to burn down, but you're not burning down these places. Why? Because those people were ethical human beings and they treated other people with kindness. They didn't give anything away, but they were fair. Okay, I say that because that impacted me. Because up until that time, even teachers had no regard for them. They showed me nothing. Now, in all this mix, my mother, she got a sense that I was messing up, so she decided I needed discipline. And the strap was insufficient discipline. And she was right. So she signed me up for what you call here the Sea Cadets. And there in Brooklyn it's called Blue Jackets Guard. And so I joined that, joined a band, got Navy uniform and so forth. And by golly, it was sharp. It was good. And I was in there for about 3 years. And then, bang, my mother couldn't afford it anymore. So I got a paper route that paid for half of it. Then I shined shoes. And I was pretty good at that as well. And that paid for the other half of it. But by that time, I had to give the money to my mother. She didn't ask for it, but I knew she needed it. So that was the end of my career there. Now, in the Air Force, of course, the civil rights movement was raging then. Thanks. And civil rights was raging. Most African Americans, as was I, burdened with the notion of internalized racism. We didn't think we were worth much of anything to anybody for any reason. I'll tell you a story. Nathan and I, if you mention his name, his good buddy, he passed away a few years ago. We were going to Washington, D.C. from New York. And he knew that one of the passengers was sitting next to us. There's a nation named him, was a president of, of Howard University. And I was sitting here, Nathan was here, and the president was sitting there. They were talking because they knew each other. And when we got off the plane, Nathan said to me, "Reggie, did you see the pilots get on?" I said, "Yeah, there was a black dude." I was kind of surprised, you know. I didn't know we had any black pilots, one of you. He said, "Yeah." He said, "Do you have any idea what the president said to me?" I said, "No." He said, quote, "Nathan, did you see the pilots?" And Nathan said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, one of them is black, right?" "Yeah." He said, "Well, are you comfortable with that?" Yeah. He wasn't comfortable with the pilot being a black guy. He didn't think that blacks had the capacity to be pilots. That's internalized racism. Okay? And I asked Nathan, "What did you say?" Nathan's great. His parents are Russian Jews. They came over 2 centuries ago, I guess. And he said, "What do you think about that, Nathan?" He said, "I think you need help." Oh, dear. You got internalized racism, brother. You got to deal with that. What have you? So it's not just poor people who suffer from that condition and so forth, up and down the system. And it has nothing to do with white folks. That's how we treated each other, and to a large extent still treat each other. And I'm talking about in the States. Canada, I've never lived in a solid black community in Canada, and they live primarily in Nova Scotia and that sort of thing and what have you. And even in Nova Scotia, where I was for a period of time, I was one of those who, what do they call me? He comes from away. He's black, but he comes from away. So, and they didn't have any Second Baptist churches there, so what the heck. And, but then, I was going to say that in basic training, I love basic training. I thought I was going to be a career officer. Enlisted man, but then I thought I might become an officer because they had not affirmative action programs, but they had officer training corps. That was it, OTS. So, didn't quite make it. But this group that I hung out with, there were Hispanics, blacks, whites, and any other color folks, guys, who just, we talked. We got together and we talked. And this is the first time I really had any real conversations with non-blacks. And it was quite fascinating. We talked about philosophy and so forth, whatever. And when we were describing what Unitarians do to a certain extent, I said, "Gee, that reminds me of the conversations we used to have." You know, not locked into fundamentalism of any kind, although we had some fundamentalists there, but we had to help them along, what have you. And people of different religions and no faith, and native spirituality, all sorts of things we were learning and that sort of thing. And so I told them about my experience when I left basic training, before I got my assignment to go to Lowry Air Force Base in Denver, Colorado. I went on leave back to New York. My family, when any person went in the military and got out of basic training, there was a big family gathering. There must have been 150 people in my grandmother's house. She had a lovely house, actually. I want to tell you about this. My grandmother was the matriarch, and her sister, my great aunt, was second in command. And that's true. You don't have that? I thought all families had that, but and so due to visiting and so forth, and people telling about their experiences, their life experiences, their military experiences, things to be wary of, things to be careful about, things to be cautious of. All right. So my great aunt says, "Reggie, I want to tell you something." So I was back in the crowd, and I stepped forward. It's kind of like in the center. I said, "Yes, ma'am." She says, "I want to tell you something. It's on you. Protect yourself. You can't trust white people." I said, "Yes, ma'am." And went back into the group. Because in our, that crew, when the matriarch says something, there is no response to it. I don't know what in heaven's name happened to me, but somebody pushed me, I'm sure. Or I was propelled by some force. It was not conscious. I just found myself back into the center. I said, "Auntie, there's something I have to say." And I could see my uncles coming around the perimeter, because they were to take me out in the yard and just whoop for answer to having anything to say. I said, "I understand why you feel the way you feel." And the reason why she felt that way is because she and her sister, my grandmother from North Carolina, walking home from school when they were 10 and 11, 9 and 11, and a truck, their little brother was walking up a further ahead, and the truck came by, two young guys in it swooped in and hit him. Boom. And he went off into the ditch, dead. They ran home and told their parents what happened. The parents told, they knew who the boys were. They went and told the parents of what those boys had done. They told the police. The police did nothing. And the owner of the house that they were renting evicted them for disclosing that information. That was a sickness in her heart. And I told her, I said, I have great compassion for you and understand that. But I said, you know what I learned? Is that you can't, no matter how deep the pain we may have, you can never, well, I cannot and will not tar all white folks with the idiocy that resulted in my uncle being killed, your family being persecuted and discriminated against. That I will not do. Then I stepped back in to the crowd, and I saw my uncles coming around the side, and I said, "Well, that's it. I hope they got my tombstone ready." Because I thought they were going to take me out. And my grandmother smiled. She says, "Yes, that makes sense." And then she did this. And they went back to their places. And I'm here to share a little bit of a story with you. And the reason why I'm saying this is because my theme is hell bent on harmony. And hell-bent means to determine to achieve something at all costs. In that moment, I was. Then, I was involved in the civil rights movement. A lot of voter registration and so forth, what have you, even though the Air Force said we shouldn't have. That's when I was in the Air Force. But the Secretary of the Air Force, Zuckert, was in Washington's D.C., and I was in Denver, Colorado, and I don't think he knew me. So I did the voter registration and that sort of thing. Then another seminal moment struck me when Malcolm X, who had become Al-Shabaab by that time, became a Muslim. And that wasn't the issue. He was on pilgrimage, Hajj, and he returned from Hajj. And I was reading in the Denver Post an editorial that was written based on a letter that he wrote. And the letter he wrote was summarizing, he wished everyone he invited and taught to become members of the Nation of Islam, which he called a racist organization, he apologized to them because he realized that Islam is not a single race dedicated faith. There are many people of all sorts of kinds. And what's happening right now is a little cloudy, but that's what he said at that time. And that struck me. I said, man, this guy's got courage to say that, because he'd done that for 25 years and he was very successful. I saw him when a kid speaking and what have you. Although I was a little too young to get involved in that. And my grandmother said, if you get involved in any all-black thing, she said that she will make sure that I will not have to worry about anything else again. And that didn't mean she was going to inherit me with any money. I mean, she would have taken me out. That's what she meant. Because that's just not where we should be. Okay. I had a great high school teacher. Great track coaches. Basketball coaches and so forth. All were white. Okay. But treated us as human beings. And like I said, all they were concerned about was performance. Training and performance. So I searched in those moments when I was in the Air Force, who am I? Who am I? I'm Reggie Newkirk, my father. And then I had a moment. I said, I have to figure out how I'm going to forgive my father. And he died when I was in Nova Scotia in 1993. And I went to the funeral in Brooklyn. And I had written a letter. And in the letter, I said many things, but the signal point in the letter was, dear Dad, I never called him that in his life. I said, I want to thank you. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, without any cynicism whatsoever. You didn't teach me much, but what you did teach me was how not to be a father. That he taught me. How not to be a dad. And for that, I'm still grateful to him for. I don't think that was necessarily his intention. But to free myself from angst, anger, perhaps hatred, and so forth, I had to figure out how to deal with that. And that's how I freed myself from it. Last thing I want to tell you about, because I see the papers are rattling over there. That's right. You don't want to mess with an MC who is a Ms. That's right. They're wicked. She got that look of my wife. You know her? No. I just want to tell you how I met Cindy. I was at the University of Wyoming, a group of us there. We've been doing a lot of social development work in Native communities, Hispanic communities, and so forth, and what have you. And we heard about a conference happening up at the University of Calgary. And I said, yeah, that's kind of cool. My buddy Jim, where the heck is Calgary? He said, it's up in Canada. What part of Canada? You know, just straight north. We were in Wyoming, straight north kind of thing. Okay, so we, whole group of us go. And we had a great time. Learned a lot, so forth, a lot about Canada, or at least Alberta, and so forth, and what have you. I was walking down one of the halls, doing one of the breaks, and I saw these three. I look at Jim and say, hey, Jim, check that out. He said, He's my blonde-haired, blue-eyed brother. And that's how we related to one another. He just passed away in April. But, yeah. Anyway, so I'm cruising. I'm going to go up and walk behind and say, hey, girls, what language are you speaking? And this one gal said, oh, it's Blackfoot. I said, oh, what's that? You know, it's not Navajo or Hopi or language that I'm familiar with. And he said, no, they told me about it. And so I just said, yeah, shook their hands and so forth, and came to Cindy, and I said, gee, you're a pretty pale Blackfoot, aren't you? They're kind of brown like me, a little lighter. And she says, well, I'm not Native. I said, well, you were talking the language. She said, yeah, well, I'm learning that. That was our first encounter. Have you? And as they say, the rest is history, because all the other guys that left Wyoming with me and drove up to Calgary, I told them, hands off. And that was in 1966. In 1968, I moved to Lethbridge to continue university there in May, and we got married in September 1968. And we're still married. Together. Yeah. And let me just summarize what I want to say is this. What I learned in my life experience, so forth, is something my grandmother used to tell us kids, and I hadn't a clue what she was talking about. And she said this, that no capacity is limited. And no one can hold you down, Reggie, without your consent. We had limitless capacities. As we get older, that changes. But the body may fail, but the aspiration of mind and heart can still fly. And that's what we need, to have that flight. So, growing up and living the life that I've strived to live and to teach our children, we had three, two boys and a girl, six grandchildren. The one boy, the youngest boy, just turned 30. He's not even married yet, much less have any children. And we told them they go together, at least in our family. They better go together. Or else, as my grandmother would say once when I made her really angry, if you don't do what I say, I'm going to knock you into the middle of next week. Or even worse, she said to me, I'll get your mother to smack the black off you. Can you imagine what that would look like? You know, that scared me. That'll knock the black off you. Okay. Wow, what is that? Okay. And we're proud of our children. And parents should be proud of their children. And our children haven't done all that we want them to do, or wish for them to do. But they've done enough. And they keep on doing enough. But it's in their way. And I find that little that I've learned of Unitarian Universalists is that you too can't do everything. But what you do is enough. And it is hopeful. It is inspiring and it is encouraging. And I just pray that you keep on keeping on and strive to grow your congregation. Thank you.
Yes, we'll just have a couple of questions. We'll just have a few moments for that. So I already see a hand up here. And are you okay? You're taking the other microphone.
Just a quick question. In our family, we have everything from indigenous native people to blacks. And is our culture that different than the American culture? And are we becoming less racist? And are Americans becoming more knowledgeable about Canada? Because years ago, they didn't know a thing about Canada. Now the Americans I've met were quite knowledgeable. And I thought, is the world getting smaller? Are we getting rid of racism?
You said a small question. Okay. I think that the United States is made up of regions. You'll get regions like Texas, Oklahoma, Alabama, southern regions and so forth. Within there, those areas, there are pockets of dyed-in-the-wool races. Right? And there are pockets of people who are not. I personally believe, notwithstanding media attention and sometimes overblowing things, I think that the problem of racism is a lot less now than it was in 57. I think that, and most people that I talk to will say that's much the same. There is a idiocratic, self-indulgent attitude that a lot of us Americans have that is exclusive of anybody who is different from us. And that difference can be whether you're white, black, brown, from north, south, east, or west. I remember growing up as a kid, I used to think that there was nothing between New York and California. You leave New York City, city limits, and you go into a black pit and come up in California. You know, that was the attitude. That was the cultural attitude of the time in New York at that time when I was growing up. Nothing of any value there. I think that, personally, I think that the 60s and 70s, the hippie movement and that sort of thing, what have you, broke down a lot of barriers. Raised some, but it broke down a lot of barriers and so forth. And I have fond memories of that. And that for me, freedom has to be for everyone, not just some. And for one of the hopeful Republican candidates for U.S. presidency said that he would build a fence from one end of the country to the other to keep the Mexicans out. That seems like it's not just foolhardy, it's just nonsense. What's needed is a change in mindset. What's needed is an understanding that people are spiritual beings, capable of learning, so forth, rather than, shall I put it, rather than sinking into a pit, a dark pit of self-indulgence, a kind of self-indulgence that folks think is reality, but is more projection of their imaginations. So we don't know what those people were like. I didn't know what white people were like. I didn't know enough of them. But I sure had a lot of imagination around that. And I think that's as people as we do. And my wife and I, we're always talking about those kinds of things and dealing with those things and what have you. Because we're just humans. Nathan and I did a session, I should tell you just quickly, in 1996 in Baltimore with the Baltimore Police Service. The chief of the police then came to us and said, we want you to deal with this, do your healing racism process, 3 days, 50 police officers. Most were senior members, some junior members and so forth. We did it. 3 days, it was a terrific session. And what happened was a number of the guys, blacks and Hispanic guys, a couple of white guys, it was about 8 of them, asked if they could have dinner with Nathan and I. I said, sure. We went out for dinner. And they were talking about the session. And here's some of the things they said. We agree with what you're saying, but the culture of the police force is quite the opposite. It doesn't believe in the oneness of humankind. It doesn't believe that blacks, that culture does not tell us that blacks are equal, that Hispanics are equal, that women are equal, have you. And they will do everything they can do on the street and so forth to discourage those members of their police force. So we did the three-day session, and we went on, did the third day session, what have you, tweaked our what we were doing to get at some of those concerns, what have you, and we did somewhat, but I don't think we were totally successful. 2 years later, that captain took a job with the Maryland State Police, and he was the chief commissioner, I guess they call him, of the police service. We talked to him and asked him, why did you leave? He said, because there wasn't enough of the staff, police officers, who were willing to change to make that police service non-discriminatory and more professional. When I saw what happened in Ferguson, I began to wonder if we're having Maryland, and there are other places, we're having Maryland, you know, a similar situation, what have you. But again, I won't encourage you to go see Straight Outta Compton. I think it's out of movies. Pretty raw. But I did. My sister-in-law and I went to see it. And one of the things we noticed in talking to people afterwards that some people didn't catch, it was kind of interesting, was that the NWA, that's Negroes with Attitude, rap group, but they use the other N-word. It's sorry. sorry. It's funny. But one of the things that was interesting was that the black police officers were as negative, as brutal, etc., towards black kids as the white police officers were. You see? So we say, well, then this is not a black or white thing. This is a culture, a police culture that sees certain groups of people and as demons, and then they demonize them. That's the attitude. So, sorry for going on so long, but you asked the question.
I think we better break now, and will you be with us downstairs as well?
And we have no place to go back home.
All right. Okay. Well, I'm sure there are a lot of other questions for you down that we'll deal with downstairs. So thank you very much. I think shedding light on really the inner journey and the inner journey towards seeing other people as rich and whole and capable. We're always trying to search for the truth and wisdom. And you've certainly brought that to us today to enlarge our world, help us to understand differently, and act differently. Thank you.